Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, August 15th. I'm Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Ambolt's supervisors vow to protect gender-affirming healthcare. A local festival celebrates a bright future for salmon in the Klamath River. And Ferndale celebrates a sporting legend. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up. In the wake of a report that found the majority of gender-diverse students feel their mental health has been negatively impacted by anti-transgender legislation across the country, the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors have vowed to protect gender-affirming health care in the county. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Citing state law, a Humboldt County proclamation condemns discrimination against gender non-conforming people and vows legal protection from, quote, attempts to impose criminal punishment, civil liability, administrative penalties, or professional sanctions based on the laws of other states. The legal shield, as per California's Senate Bill 107, is part of a Board of Supervisors proclamation that recognizes, quote, the importance of gender-affirming health care, including mental health services, as matters of essential daily living and equality. Approved at the August 12th board meeting, the proclamation affirms the county's commitment to uphold the rights of, quote, two-spirit, transgender, gender nonconforming, and intersex residents and visitors, abbreviated in the proclamation as 2STGI. As noted in the proclamation, the report comes during a backlash against transgender social acceptance, with hundreds of bills passed nationwide that have, quote, changed the lives of 2STGI people. The proclamation was read aloud by Supervisor Natalie Arroyo, who sponsored it with Supervisor Steve Madrone. It describes how the bills negatively impact quality of life and says access to health care is helpful.
Already over 937 bills filed across the nation in 2025 as of June, including six in California, and multiple federal actions have already changed the lives of 2STGI people. And whereas these bills and other actions disproportionately target 2STGI people and include efforts to prohibit access to life-saving medical care, prevent youth from playing sports alongside their friends, erase people's identities from vital records and state driver's licenses, ban books that include 2STGI people in history, prohibit people from using restrooms and facilities where they are safe and affirmed for who they are, frame transgender people as inherently dishonorable, and falsely conflate transgender women and girls with men seeking to harm women and girls. And whereas studies have shown that access to gender-affirming healthcare improves the overall well-being of transgender people and is associated with better mental health outcomes and lower risks of suicide, which aligns with Humboldt County's Community Health Improvement Plan's focus on suicide prevention as a key public health priority.
Also cited in the proclamation is a May 2024 Humboldt County 2S LGBTQIA+ School Climate Survey of middle and high school students. The survey found that, quote, the majority of gender-diverse students report their mental health as being negatively impacted by anti-transgender legislation from across the country, not feeling safe at school, and avoiding school restrooms due to fears about their personal safety. It also found that, quote, nearly one-third of 2STGI youth report living in fear of losing their housing due to being or seeming queer, with 10% reporting having been kicked out of their home in the prior year due to anti-queer bias. The proclamation says that, quote, in Humboldt County, we believe in and reaffirm the inherent value of each and every resident of our county, including our 2STGI communities, individuals, and families, without exception. Ashia Kandrian Morton of Queer Humboldt accepted the proclamation and described how youth involvement led to its creation.
It's very meaningful for us because the proclamation happened because of youth advocacy in our community. It started when Humboldt County community members reached out to us at Queer Humboldt, requesting help in creating a proclamation such as this one. Our youth leaders facilitated a series of sessions where they drafted a sample proclamation and then met with elected officials such as yourselves to discuss this idea and advocate for the proclamation. Like the proclamation said, all over the country, politicians are trying to gain political points by abandoning the rights of trans people, and it is especially significant to us that we have local support from the Board of Supervisors here in Humboldt County. Thank you so much for doing the right thing and letting our trans community members know that you haven't forgotten them and their rights.
A leading member of the county employee Queer Affinity Group described the proclamation as being well-timed.
I just wanted to say thank you so much for bringing this proclamation and for accepting it, because I think it's really important now more than ever to show members of our community that we stand with them. And that they are important to us and that they matter, because it can be very scary and difficult time right now for members of the trans and two-spirit gender nonconforming community.
Supervisor Mike Wilson described the proclamation as supportive of basic democratic principles. He said, quote, "When we as a society respect how individuals understand and experience their own gender, it upholds our fundamental principle that people should be free to live as their true selves without facing discrimination or being forced to conform to others' expectations about how they should be." The proclamation's approval was unanimous. Arroyo reminded that August is Transgender History Month in California, saying, quote, "I urge people to learn about trans history. There's a lot to learn for all of us." In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The annual Salmon Festival will be held tomorrow, Saturday, in Klamath del Norte. Hosted by the Yurok tribe, this will be the 61st iteration of the festival, which will feature a parade, a fun run, live music, film screenings, kids' activities, basket weaving demonstrations, and stick game, basketball, and arm wrestling tournaments. Despite the absence of salmon during this year's festivities, the theme of the festival will be, quote, "celebrating the spectacular start of the Klamath River's renewal," end quote. According to Joseph L. James, the chairman of the Yurok tribe, the Klamath River looks better than at any other time in living memory. As has been reported by KMUD, thousands of salmon have started returning to the upper reaches of the Klamath River following the dismantling of the last of the four dams along the river a year ago. So while this year's festival comes too soon for commercial fishing to take place during it, the tribe is confident that the Klamath Salmon Run will recover. The Klamath Salmon Celebration is not the country's only salmon festival, and we have a report here from our colleagues at National Native News about a similar festival in Alaska. Antonia Gonzalez introduces the story.
Alaska's annual Salmon Fest is a three-day music festival that advocates for the protection of healthy salmon through song and educational resources, but it also highlights Alaska Native culture through workshops and demonstrations. KDLL's Hunter Morrison attended one teaching, Yupik Phrases, and has the story.
Between musical performances, Casey Jack takes the stage to introduce himself to an audience of about two dozen people.
I'll just say hi real quick. Maybe some of y'all have heard this.
The audience repeats the word back.
You know, you gotta bring that sound from the back of your throat. You gotta, like, you know, like you're almost like clearing a spit. One more time.
Jack teaches the group other phrases, like how are you and where are you from, during the 20-minute Yupik beginner phrase session. The session is one of a handful at the music festival highlighting Alaska Native language and culture.
In general, Indigenous voices are important to be listening to.
The Yupik session was put together by an organizer who identified themselves as Foot.
I think that's kind of our duty as people who maybe are not from this land from time immemorial to respect and learn from the people who have been.
While the festival's main focus is the music and environmental message, Foote says Alaska Native people have been represented at Salmon Fest since its kickoff in 2011. Jack, who led this year's Yupik workshop, says demonstrations like the ones at Salmon Fest help keep Indigenous language and culture alive.
Language is intrinsic to identity, you know? You know, how can you be someone without your language? The language is the very vessel that you're using to pass down your values, your culture.
The workshop wasn't the first time Jack has taught his native language, but Jack has never held class at a music festival. Here's Foote, the coordinator.
It's called Salmon Fest, and salmon people and the stewards of this land are Alaska Native people. And so if you're sticking true to it being about salmon, it's probably also going to be about salmon people.
Foote says the festival's environmental advocacy is as much about the people who rely on healthy salmon as the fish themselves. Reporting from the Kenai Peninsula Fairgrounds in Nanilchik, I'm Hunter Morrison.
Speaking of language being intrinsic to identity, 15 signs in Sulatluk, the language of the Wiyot tribe, have been installed along the Humboldt Bay waterfront. The signs highlight Wiyot words for local animals, plants, places, and cultural practices. The project, supported by the National Endowment for the Arts, is a partnership between the Wiyot tribe, the Ink People Center for Arts and Culture, and the city of Eureka. The signs, designed by local artist Kay Lopez, feature QR codes that link directly to Wiyot language resources, share images of local flora and fauna, and depictions of coastal landscapes. A bill moving through the California Assembly aims to address potential fraud within the state's school system, with a particular attention paid to charter schools, which public school advocates say are failing both its students and taxpayers because of poor financial management and lack of adherence to academic standards. Mark Richardson reports.
Public school advocates say the charter school system is broken in California, citing low academic standards, excessive expenses, and poor management. A bill in the California legislature is aimed at reforming the system. In California and many other states, laws give parents the option of sending their kids to a private charter school rather than public schools and using state funds to pay the tuition. Harold Burris, executive director of the Network for Public Education, says charter school growth is out of control and it's hurting public education.
The growth in charter schools of late have been in what we call mega charters, very, very large charter schools, many of them online charter schools. They have been really prone to some pretty outlandish scandals.
In 2024, the state had 1,300 active charter schools and 7 all-charter districts, with almost 650,000 students enrolled. Assembly Bill 84 focuses on enhancing accountability and financial oversight for schools, particularly in charter schools, and aims to address potential fraud and abuse within the system. Opponents say the bill could increase restrictions on charter schools, potentially defunding them and limiting parental choice. Burris says many of the state's charter schools are online and don't have to maintain the same level of academic rigor as other schools in order to remain open.
They have the incentive to bring lots of kids in to keep the costs low, and they don't have to worry particularly about academic success because they probably will not be shut down.
She says the issues that have made news headlines involving some California charter schools include cheating on reporting attendance figures, what she terms outrageous expenses, and academic fraud. The reform bill has passed in the state assembly and is pending in the state senate. Burris says it faces stiff opposition.
Whenever you try to do any reform with charter schools, and this has happened in the past in California and in other states, there's a very powerful charter lobby, especially in California, and they tend to fight reforms tooth and nail.
For California News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Changes have been made to the state public assistance program known as CalWORKS to give families more flexibility to use the benefits the program supports. The program provides financial assistance and help with job training and employment to families with children. Zamon Perez reports.
A coalition of advocacy groups has pushed major reforms of a state public assistance program through the California General Assembly, and now says even more changes could improve its impact. The program, known as CalWORKS, provides financial assistance for families with children and helps parents find employment and job training. Rebecca Gonzalez with the Western Center on Law and Policy says CalWORKS was created when negative stereotypes of people on public assistance were common. She says some new provisions give families more freedom to tailor the program's work-related services to their needs.
We really wanted to reimagine the program to be more supportive of families, to give families more choice in the activities they're pursuing and how they are developing the tools they need to support their families, whether that be going to school or a training program or going straight into work.
That includes reassessing what have been mandatory activities for people who already have specific skills and not reducing benefits at the beginning of a family's enrollment as they try to meet the program requirements. In addition to the Western Center on Law and Poverty, the coalition working on the reforms includes End Child Poverty in California and SEIU California. More than 500,000 families receive CalWORKS assistance, according to the County Welfare Directors Association of California. Gonzalez says the coalition isn't finished making recommendations to improve the program, including the rules for CalWORKS families dealing with a truant child.
When a CalWORKS family, when the child is not going to school, they would sanction the families and take away part of their grant, which is really difficult for these families because that just destabilizes the families.
She says the coalition also plans to advocate for removing the requirement that a person must work less than 100 hours a month to qualify for CalWORKS, regardless of income. Gonzalez notes 100 hours a month doesn't guarantee enough income to support a family. I'm Simone Perez, California News Service.
Up next is a whiplash tour across rural America with the Public News Service's Yonder Report, which has stories on the effects of hurricanes in Appalachia, flooding in Texas, and how mobile and manufactured homes give you less shelter from extreme heat than other houses.
Appalachian states are making preparations as hurricanes become more intense and inflict greater damage due to climate change. Last year, Hurricane Helene hit western Tennessee and eastern North Carolina, resulting in heavy flooding and widespread damage to communities, roads, and infrastructure. Tennessee state climatologist Andrew Joyner says wetter, warmer weather is to blame.
The potential for these events to happen kind of back to back again has increased. It doesn't mean it will increase. The ingredients are there for this to happen more often.
Joyner says extreme rainfall events that used to take place every 100 years or so could soon occur every 25 years. He notes flash droughts also are more frequent, similar to those experienced last year in Tennessee.
The one in June had a big impact on your corn crop. The one in August was really big impact on soybeans. And the one in October was really impactful on livestock.
Experts expect climate change to extend hurricane season, and they're working with state and local governments in Appalachian states to plan mitigation strategies. In central Texas, massive storms last month caused millions in damage and halted farming operations. Susanna Brown has an update.
Weeks of relentless flooding in San Saba County downed miles of fences, fundamental for Texas hill country ranchers to contain livestock and control grazing. Despite aid programs, ranchers facing six-figure fencing repair bills are left covering most of the costs themselves. In addition to losing their home, Connie and Buddy Adams saw major damage on their 350-acre ranch.
A lot of the fencing was all down, and all of our equipment got underwater in our shop and our shed.
San Saba also has seen an outpouring of support from neighbors in nearby states, according to rancher Pam Perry Wallace.
There have been donations of fencing products, which has been a great help. The volunteers are just amazing.
I'm Susanna Brown.
Rural folks looking for affordable housing often turn to manufactured or mobile homes. And as climate change warms the planet, they're far more susceptible to heat-related deaths than others living in houses or apartments. Reporter Catherine Davis-Young says manufactured homes capture more heat than traditional homes.
Mobile home lots where people live tends to be less shade, more concrete, a lot of impermeable surfaces.
Mobile homes built before federal regulations were adopted in the 1970s are the most susceptible to heat buildup. Still, they're used in many poorer states like Mississippi, West Virginia, and Kentucky. Davis-Young says some owners risk their health to save money.
Sticking with the effects of increased heat on people, Here is a report from our partners at Texas News Service about how strategic planting of trees could reduce temperatures in so-called heat islands by at least 15 degrees.
A groundbreaking project is planned for the Southwestern Medical District in Dallas that developers say will improve health and help cool the environment. The medical district is working with the Texas Trees Foundation to add more trees and landscaping to the corridor and build a park in the middle of the 14 acres of land that houses Parkland Hospital, UT Southwestern Medical Center, and Children's Hospital. Project manager David Woodley says 28 sensors throughout the corridor are collecting information about temperature, pollutants, and other factors that impact climate. He says data gathered will help determine where trees are planted.
We're able to model how different design solutions might affect thermal comfort based on all these data points. So we could put in the arrangement of trees that we're thinking about and see how will that perform.
The medical district is Dallas' largest urban heat island. The trees are expected to reduce the temperature in the corridor by at least 15 degrees. An 8-acre signature park will be built between the three hospitals. Project Director Lanny McClellan says a survey of employees and medical students shows they need a place to unwind from the stress of their jobs. She adds the green space is designed to improve their overall mental health.
We want a place to go out, to escape the walls of the building, to get out in nature and just to be.
Once the 4,000 trees are planted, the sensors will be reinstalled to determine the project's efficacy. McClellan says they recently shared the information with planners in Australia and hope the concept will catch on in other areas.
There's a lot of research going on in this topic, but there's not a lot of projects, like real life projects that are trying to make a difference happening. And so that's where this is so cutting edge.
Construction on the project is scheduled to start in the fourth quarter of 2026. I'm Frida Ross, Texas News Service.
Thank you, Frida. And finally, here is Ray Hamill with his ever-present Friday fixture, the Sports Report, which this time features an avalanche of upcoming high school sports and news of Ferndale's honoring of a local legend.
The fall high school sports season is just around the corner as we get set for what will be a busy few months here on the North Coast. Hello and welcome to this week's K-Mud News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the fall high school sports and what we can expect in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports news, including some Ute motocross news and how the town of Ferndale recently honoured a local legend. But first up, the local high school fall sports season is just around the corner. Most of the HDNL teams began their official preseason practice this week, with just 2 weeks to go to the first football games of the year. The fall also features volleyball, girls and boys soccer, girls and boys cross country, girls golf, and girls tennis. The St. Bernards and Arcata girls are the defending Little 4 and Big 5 champions in volleyball, respectively, and both programs will be hoping to retain their titles this fall. The Crusaders edged Hoopa for the conference championship by just one win last year, and both schools should be front runners once again this year in what could be an exciting race for the conference championship. In the Big 5, the Arcata girls held their nerve down the stretch of conference play a year ago on their way to edging Del Norte for the title. Head coach Laurie Griffith has built a powerhouse program at Arcata, and our players did not drop a set in league action over the final six Big 5 games last year, including a straight sets win over their closest rival Del Norte. This year, however, both Del Norte and Eureka should challenge Arcata for the league crown in what looks like it could be a three-horse race, although both McKinleyville and Fortuna will be hoping to also make some noise in conference and push the front runners. The Tigers should also be among the front runners in both girls' golf and girls' tennis. Few programs in any HDNL sports have dominated the way the Arcata girls have in both of those sports in recent years, and there's every reason to expect more of the same this fall. The race for the championship in boys and girls soccer appears wide open once again. HDNL boys soccer has been one of the most competitive local high school sports over the past 2 years, with several teams challenging for the crown during that spell. 2 years ago, it was the Del Norte boys who prevailed in a thrilling race that went right down to the final week of the season. While last year, the Fortuna boys re-established themselves as the most dominant program in the league in what was another thrilling race that was not decided until the final afternoon of competition. Arcata and Eureka will also be expected to challenge the defending champs, while a consistently dangerous McKinleyville team also could be in the mix. HGNL girls soccer, meanwhile, has two conferences, a Big Four and a Little Four. The Eureka girls have dominated the Big Four in recent years and are the three-time defending conference champs, but the Fortuna Huskies pushed them all the way a year ago and appear poised to challenge once again this fall. The Arcata Tigers also have been a force in the Big Four in recent years and will also be looking to challenge this year, while a competitive McKinleyville program should also be dangerous. The Little Four should also be a very competitive league. The Del Norte girls enjoyed a huge breakout season a year ago on their way to the title, and they will be looking to carry that momentum into the new season. St. Bernard's and Ferndale should also be in the mix, while an always dangerous South Fork team will look to continue to improve this fall after a young group of Cubs proved to be a very difficult challenge for the rest of the conference in 2024. We'll take a more in-depth look at what to expect on the HDNL football fields on the next K-Mud News Sports Report, but it should be another exciting fall on the North Coast with wide-open battles expected in both the Big Four and Little Four. Last year saw Ferndale and Arcata share the L4 crown, while Del Norte won a fifth straight Big Four pennant. As we've mentioned before, this year's Big Four returns to a home-and-away round-robin format with six league games for each team instead of three, all of which should make for an exciting race for the championship. The new season kicks off in 2 weeks with conference play in both the Big Four and the Little Four set to begin in early October. Switching gears, last week was a good one for one young local motocross rider. McKinleyville High School junior Davin Kane made the trip to Tennessee to compete in the Amateur National Motocross Championships and did a good job representing the North Coast. Kane placed 15th out of 42 riders in the 125C class, but beyond his impressive performance on the national stage, it was the experience that he says he will remember the most. To get there, Kane had to go through a series of qualifying races, including the area qualifiers back in February, and three rounds of regional qualifying, traveling as far north as Washington and as far south as Los Angeles. In baseball news, legendary local coach Reggie Christensen was honored over the weekend by the town of Ferndale at the annual Joe Escher Day. Escher, a Ferndale native, enjoyed a 12-year major league career and holds the MLB record for most innings pitched in a single game, throwing an incredible 26 innings for the Boston Braves in a 1-1 tie with the Brooklyn Dodgers back in 1920. Every year, he is remembered by the town of Ferndale on Joe Escher Day, along with a guest of honor who has impacted sports in the area. This year, Christensen was the guest of honor for all of his achievements in charge of Sacramento State. Christensen, who played and coached at Ferndale High School before joining the Hornets coaching staff, has established himself as one of the most respected college baseball coaches on the West Coast and was named the Western Athletic Conference Coach of the Year for the third time this spring. And that's this week's K-Mud News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks to our engineer Michael McCaskill, and thanks to our reporters Daniel Mintz, Antonia Gonzalez, Hunter Morris, Mark Richardson, Zamon Paris, Ross Brown, Susan Brown, Catherine Davis Young, Frida Ross, and Ray Hamill. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Sigurd Bjorn. Thank you for listening.